how can we engage the culture, especially in books, music, and movies, with charitable and critical discussion through a lens of faith, and as a means of drawing ourselves and others closer to Jesus? I'm Ali LaVille.
And I'm Andy Norton. This is Though They Die. Talk about the things of this world through the lens of eternity. Today we're discussing the Fellowship of the Ring. Welcome to the show.
And there it is.
There it is.
There
folks.
It is, ladies and gentlemen. Ah, the big reveal. Yes. What you've all been wanting this whole time. How does a Catholic podcast exist that talks about media and they have not yet discussed?
Well, we have discussed it many times. It's come up.
That's true. That's how hardcore we are. We haven't even done an episode yet, and we've already
referenced it many times.
Yeah, you'll notice we have a new table.
Yes.
Maybe you didn't notice that. But notice, please. Look at this beautiful.
Perceive Cabre. It.
Yeah.
I think it's appropriate for Lord of the Rings, so we went with a wooden table.
Wooden table. Because there's so much wood.
Totally.
In the Lord of the Rings.
Next time we'll be talking about, I don't know, The Matrix, and it'll be a steel.
Something else. Surgical steel.
every time just suggesting
kitchen grade steel countertop.
Yeah, we have a budget for that, right? No.
No, we don't.
Here we are talking about the Fellowship of the Ring, to be specific. Yeah.
Yes,
the first part of the Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to be discussing the movie.
The movie. Yes. Oh, yeah. Definitely the movie.
The movie.
The movie. Yeah. Because, we talk about movies, books, music, of course,
that's
on this podcast.
That's
right. But we mostly talk about movies.
Movies.
And the thing is, most people will consume The Fellowship of the Ring these days, probably the movie first.
Cinema.
Yeah. I do want to talk about that, though. And maybe, a couple things I wanted to get into, kind of first of all, why watch it, and maybe why are we talking about it too, mm-hmm. Many years after the fact of it coming out, but also a little bit of how to watch it. And specifically, we wanted to address that question of if you have never read the books, is there anything you should be paying attention to, any way that you should be approaching the film? And if you, if you have or haven't, I feel it would be helpful to have some tips on that.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Why are we talking about this?
Well, mm-hmm. I think worth noting too is that we will inevitably draw on the books because we both.
Oh yes,
know
absolutely.
The book. Yep. Mm-hmm. So while we are talking specifically about the movie, it's not as though we're not gonna be talking about Tom Bombadil because
Tom Bombadil,
he's worth discussing.
Yeah, totally,
we
absolutely.
Love Tom Bombadil. Yeah. I love Tom Bombadil. Everyone, I know a lot of people that are this is the dumbest. Why on earth?
You might be a bigger fan than I am.
He's so great. He's so funny.
If we're talking to people who don't know the movie, they don't even know who that is.
They don't even know who that is because it doesn't exist.
They might know that it's not in the movie. But yes. Okay. So why watch the Fellowship of the Ring?
Yes. Yes.
Why?
So I think it's worth watching because for the first and most obvious reason I would say is because it's an epic.
Yeah.
And I think it's probably, I want to watch what I say here. This isn't a researched thing that I'm about to say, which is all of the things I say. People listening Lee, when do you ever research? I think it's one of the most recent epics as far as a film goes. Well, the whole installment is, but they were still using a lot of makeup, a lot of practical sort of effects. And there's plenty of movies that do this, but it stands out as being a well-done epic. And we don't get any more the days of, the Ten Commandments or Ben-Hur, where you
Ben-Hur.
Had these just monstrous sets and monstrous cast list and all this stuff. But I would say the Lord of the Rings and the Fellowship here as we start is, I don't know, probably as close as we get in recent memory, I would say. There's been others, certainly. Yeah. I know Blade Runner did a ton of miniature work. Even the prequels in Star Wars had a ton of miniature work, and it's kind of a...
Dune
was an epic.
Yeah, but you're right, though. Even The Lord of the Rings, so with The Fellowship of the Ring, it's so integral with the rest of the trilogy because they actually filmed all three at the same time. It was just...
so good.
They're just down there in New Zealand for a very long time putting together this epic. So you're saying watch it because it's an epic.
So it has relevance as far as attaining excellence, I would say, cinematically, by nature of the quality of product they're putting out and the fact that it is an epic and it does... I'm about to tangent into a different point, but I think it's worth watching because it's an epic. Yeah.
I think that's fair. Cause with that, I think it's not just epic scale, but I think that it taps into, the moral kind of compass of epics, right?
Point two.
I think one of the big, things with the Lord of the Rings that I love is that it just, how do I say this? So many other fantasy films, especially, you might be watching it and you're like, ooh, like this just, mm-hmm. there's no good moral compass in this. Even the way that they approach like magic and things like that, just like can just be very kind of all over the place and pagan and all that. Lord of the Rings has such a solid moral like compass to it. And you know, the good people are seeking to do good. They don't always do good, but they're seeking to do good. There's like a story of temptation that's clearly like maps onto like our experience of sin and temptation. That makes sense. Like good is good and evil's evil. And it's not glorifying evil as good or trying to subvert expectations or that sort of thing.
Or trying to confuse if there is actual good and evil and this sort of stuff and acknowledging the reality that good and evil are not on level playing fields, right? That good ultimately always prevails and evil is simply an absence of that good for one reason or another. Whereas you have other franchises that will say it's like, you know, this balance in the force, you know, like there's, which is like, no, it's like, good is far superior.
They even make a point of saying that like that evil cannot create, but rather evil perverts, which is why the, you know, do you know, Malkier?
What's the previous?
Oh,
it's Cimmerillion dude, like really evil, worse than Sauron.
Oh,
Malkor? Dude, he's the worst. Yeah, he's the worst. It's awful.
Yeah. Well, like in Saruman, I think in this film says, "Do you know what's the line about orcs? Do you know where orcs are?"
I know what you're talking about. Right. Yeah.
And so I think that sort of moral framework is so good. And so if you don't know this, J.R.R. Tolkien was a practicing Catholic, lover of the Eucharist, etc. And so that maps so much onto the books. It's kind of a joke because, of course, C.S. Lewis is all about like allegory, and Tolkien was like, no, it's not allegory. My book's not allegorical. But so many things in the book are very much like Catholic imagery.
Well, it's the beauty, I think. So we've made, just to backtrack, we've made a couple points so far. The first is watch it because it's an epic. The second is watch it for its moral significance, which I think you can enjoy even if you don't come from a Catholic upbringing. I think because it's true, good, and beautiful, right? So it's you know, it's just winked at the
camera. I saw that.
I hate myself. Okay. And the third thing now that we're getting into is that this is kind of a side point, but I just wanted to clarify what we're saying. He's writing what he knows, and by virtue of being a Catholic man living out his faith, that bleeds into the work very well, I would say. And it's, not an allegory, so saith Tolkien.
Yeah.
But there's very clear lines to be connected.
Well, absolutely.
Which is beautiful, I think, and worth noting. And I think that, I mean, just as I said this, I was doing an acting workshop with some friends recently, and our final conference that we had before we did some work was, we were talking about how you cannot write what you don't know.
Yeah.
It is impossible. If you try to write what you don't know,
you'll still end up.
It's just gonna gonna be a faux, or people will sense that it is fake, even if they're not, you know, venomous about it. They will know that it's not real because you can only write what you know. You can't, as an artist, do anything else. And so that's where this is beautiful, though, is because you can see the fruit of his faith with the Lord through his work, because he's writing what he knows, and the truth and the goodness and the beautiful that he's experienced.
I love that so much. I'm excited to get into like what we see in terms of like the spiritual significance. So we're definitely going to get a lot of that. So, and so another thing I guess I would just say, like, for why to watch it, I think final reason is I feel like today there's not always like things that you can just connect with anyone on. Not that everyone's seen The Lord of the Rings, but a lot of people have.
Many.
And most people are familiar with it. And it actually, something that's, thank you to all the memers out there. I feel like The Lord of the Rings is almost back in people's public conscience because of all the memes. And having like that common ground of like understanding that movie, plenty of people enjoy it without really appreciating or accepting like the moral, you know, significance of it. But having like that common ground to discuss it, I think is really, really helpful for engaging other people, whether that's your Christian, you know, brother or sister, or someone else, like someone who doesn't share like the same moral framework. But for some people, you might not be able to say, you know, well, that's just like Jesus or just like Saint whoever. But you could talk about like, oh, that reminds me of the way in which, you know, Gandalf like lays his life down, or like, you know, the way that Frodo is like fighting against temptation or carrying this weight for the world.
Yeah.
Like there's ways you can talk about that, and someone who does not have the same background as you, you can communicate.
Totally.
And maybe get to deeper truths. And so I think almost an evangelistic tool. So yeah, that'd be a little bit of why to watch it. And then briefly, that's just how to watch it. So if you haven't read the books, do you think it's fine to just go ahead and watch the movies?
Man, wow. We're just going to
let's
it,
go for
man.
It. Let's offend
so
people right now.
I think, I mean, yeah. Yeah. You know, who am I to say you have to absolutely read the books? I think you can do either.
Yeah.
I definitely saw the movies before. I haven't finished the books, which I'm ashamed to say, but I've read the first book.
Don't be ashamed.
And for me, I think, so the Council of Elrond is anecdotally what I have found by many to be the hardest part of book one to get through.
Right. Yes. No, that's very true.
I loved it. I was so in it. I was, yeah. I did not feel the length that everyone else seemed to feel in trying to get through it. I thought it was engaging and interesting. And I'm also the guy that when people are complaining about the green light being described for 3 pages in The Great Gatsby or whatever, I was like, wow, this is really good. This is really cool. You know, as like a punk high school kid kind of thing. So I understand that maybe I receive literature a little differently, but I think you can do either. I really do. I maybe, you know, it depends on how you receive things. So the book is in greater detail, of course, than the film. By nature of, you know, you
being,
can you imagine if they did everything in the book?
No,
in the,
film,
the movie would be hours long. It's already hours long, you know, it'd be hours upon hours. So I don't know. I mean, it depends on, so if you're a detail person, read the book, then watch the movie, then read the book, because you'll enjoy, you know, receiving more when you read the book after you watch the movie kind of thing. Yeah. If you're big picture guy, maybe read the book first, then watch the movie.
Yep.
I don't know. That would be probably my recommendation. Yeah. I genuinely think you can enjoy both in whatever order you
do. I agree with that. Totally agree with that. I think you're totally right to say that. If you've only watched the movies, that's fine. Like, don't be ashamed of that. You know, go read the books if you have a chance, if you have the bandwidth for it. If you've read the books, I'd say try to enjoy the movie just as it is, as a movie, because I think that it's an incredible cinematic experience. There are some people who'd be like, well, it should have been a miniseries. Like this, you know, they should have given it.
That wasn't even
a
thing then.
It wasn't even a thing.
And well, it was. That's a lie. It totally was.
There were miniseries.
There were miniseries.
But there weren't people funding necessarily a miniseries of that kind of caliber and level that it needed. And also, here's the thing. Miniseries are not always what they're like cracked up to be. It's such a long investment as a viewer, whereas a movie, you sit down, you watch the movie, and by the end of the evening, the movie's over, and it was either good or it was bad.
Yeah.
And these movies are amazing cinematic experiences. I had a great experience with my daughter watching the trilogy for the first time, and I did not have any like, you know, you need to read the books first. I was just like, I think she'll love this movie, the movies. And engage with them well. And so what I did is actually as sort of an experiment, when I watched them with her, I didn't jump in with any like background information or like, just so you know, actually like this is this and that is that.
Okay.
And even when she asked questions, I gave the most minor clarification I could, because I wanted to see if the movies held up on their own or if you really needed the
relying
books.
Relying on the kind
of... Yeah. Because I've read the books, and so I was like, I'm unsure how much they stand up without them, or is it almost like this weird thing where, they kind of assume that you know this or that you're gonna look it up.
Yeah.
The movies hold up incredibly well in that regard, and I think that they don't rely on the books at all. It's amazing. Yeah, like at all. I think that it's kind of insane how well that they do without them. And part of that is too, because they do cut out major characters like Tom Bombadil,
right? That take up a chapter.
Excise
so,
that. Yeah. They definitely cut out people like Gondori Gon. I think is you haven't read the book. There's people who help them through the paths of the dead. Oh, yeah. It's very like some significant people, and they also do a lot of like simplifying of characters. Mm-hmm. So this was something that I know when it first came out, people would complain about Faramir was not as like complex as he was in the books.
Yeah.
And the person I complain about is Éomer is very much not as complex as he was in the books.
Yeah.
So they had to rely on like cinematic stereotypes for these characters and lean into more like grasping at any tension or conflict that they could for cinematic reasons.
Right.
But I think when you realize that that's what they had to do for it to make it a sense as a movie,
mm-hmm.
I think it's incredible what they did. And I say, if the movies aren't like good enough for you or whatever, like, cool, enjoy the books. But like, I really think you should take just watch the movies and engage with them as on their own thing and just let them be amazing.
Totally.
So yeah, that'd be that.
There we go. Well, can we, before we get any further, Andy, can you be Mr. Synopsis for us?
Oh my gosh, I forgot to even pull up a synopsis.
It's okay. Perfectly all right.
Synopsis of Fellowship of the Ring. I could totally just do a synopsis, but I'll pull one up. Here we go. The future. I have no idea if this is a good synopsis. Normally, I
first search out. Result. First come search on. Result. Come on.
First search result. Here we go. The future of civilization rests in the fate of the One Ring, which has been lost for centuries. Powerful forces are unrelenting in their search for it, but fate has placed it in the hands of a young hobbit named Frodo Baggins of the Shire, who inherits the ring and steps into legend. A daunting task lies ahead for Frodo when he becomes the ring bearer to destroy the One Ring in the fires of Mount Doom, from whence it was forged.
You went through so many character voices. I was so amazed. I was on the edge of my seat. I was like, oh.
Oh, man. Thank you. That's awesome. That's a good thing. But
no, it's great. I got a kick out of it.
Good. That's so funny. Powerful forces are unrelenting in their search for it. I love that.
Yeah, that was nice.
I love how like kind of general that is. When, of course, for me, it's just like there's ring wraiths coming after them, you know? The Black Riders are searching for them. Gosh. Yes. I mean, that's a great synopsis, actually. That's one of the best synopsis I've seen. That's what the story's about. And I'm sure, I mean, most people watching this probably have seen it, probably know it.
Yeah.
But so maybe just to take a few minutes for those who haven't, that's what the story is. There's a kind of a prologue at the beginning where you see the One Ring and how it was forged in the dark by the Dark Lord Sauron. He used it to dominate these other people, and he distributed rings to other people and then dominated them through the One Ring to rule them all.
Yeah.
And so then they march against him and he,
not the people with the rings.
Yes, the people with the rings. Well,
march
some
against
of them,
him. Some of them.
Actually, good call. Some of them don't. So I was just mentioning the ring wraiths, of course. So some of the nine men to whom he gave rings were corrupted and became his servants. Yeah. Others, like the elves, and I believe the dwarves too.
I think the dwarves too.
They fought against the corruption of the ring. And there was the last alliance of elves and men that marches against Sauron. His fingers cut off. He's dispersed and defeated. And they're about to destroy the ring, but it's not destroyed. And then because of corruption, because of temptation, and then it gets lost and it passes into mystery.
Time passed. Yeah,
legend.
And the ring
legend became mystery.
Legend became mystery. Yeah, that's right. The narration
incredible. It's incredible.
Say what you will about the movies, if you're one of those like they're garbage, just listen to the narration though. Oh my god,
the opening narration is so stellar. I don't think any other narration has beat that one.
No,
like prologue at all.
I don't think so.
Yeah,
I mean, I haven't researched all the narrations ever. So
ever done.
Just in the moment right now, amazing.
It's an incredible prologue. And so it sets up the story where then Frodo Baggins comes into the possession of the ring through his uncle/cousin, and then he's set
Bilbo
on this journey.
Bilbo is also his cousin.
Bilbo is technically his cousin, but he is of an age that it's like a uncle type of relationship. And so he calls him Uncle Bilbo, but he's technically his cousin.
Okay. So, wow, that's really good to know.
Yeah. Background, which you don't know if you only watched the films.
Oh my gosh, and they don't even touch on the whole the House of Bagginses and all of the
Saxville Bagginses.
Yeah, there's so many. They really, I'm just realizing they totally go into all that in the book.
Yeah.
And the family history and some of the stuff and in the movie or just.
They quickly get to the birthday party where Bilbo disappears and where Frodo starts.
It's my 111th birthday.
thank you for doing that. I love that. Like, stumbles out of his mouth.
It's like,
happy birthday.
Oh,
So then eventually he gets on this journey. He realizes Gandalf, this wizard, tells him that that he has to take the ring to Rivendell, and Elrond will tell them what to do because there's these black riders, ring wraiths, that are chasing them, pursuing the ring.
They're also way more intense in the books, I'm realizing.
The books, yeah, they are scary in the books.
I mean, they're scary in the movie, don't get me wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
But I will say, scary. In the movie, I think I believed the suspense more in the book than in the movie. Because in the book, they, you know, come upon a different house where we think that the hobbitses and Strider are
hobbitses.
And in the book, the same occurs. But in the movie, for whatever reason, because they're just across the street.
Yeah,
in the movie,
when
you can kind of
like the stabbing.
Yeah. But in the book, for whatever reason, I was still just not convinced that they were gonna.
Yeah,
there's a few things, and there's the betrayal in the town. Like someone totally sells
Bill
him
Ferny.
Out.
Bill Ferny,
the worst.
Yeah, he is the worst.
He is the worst
because he comes back at the very end too. Because he had the measure of the king.
I've only read the first book.
No spoilers.
So he's really the worst. Wow,
he's really bad.
He's
bad.
Okay.
So anyhow, like basically the basic story is they get set off on this fellowship of the ring, right? Yes. You have the Council of Elrond where they have a fellowship of nine walkers to match the nine riders. Isn't that cool? Right?
What? Yeah.
That's what it is, yeah. So it's the Fellowship of the Ring gets sent off, and they're starting on their journey towards Mount Doom. And of course, in this first part, they don't get there.
No.
They get part of the way.
Yes.
And it ends with this climactic betrayal / like temptation or corruption that happens of one of the Fellowship. The Fellowship is broken. That's the whole thing.
Yeah.
And they all split up into these different groups. There's basically three groups at that point.
Because the book and movie end in different places. Yeah.
Oh, it's pretty dang close.
Right. Yeah. But it's slightly.
Only slightly.
Because the movie ends with them going their separate ways. Merry and Pippin have been captured.
Yeah.
And then we have Legolas.
The hunters.
Short man.
They call him. The short man?
What is
Gimli?
Gimli! I remember Hobbit, the Hobbit.
Yeah.
Those dwarves better. Gimli and then Strider. And then Samwise Gamgee and Bilbo.
Yep.
Or Frodo Baggins.
Yep. Sam and Frodo. And then the three hunters.
Right.
And then the two other hobbits, Pippin and Merry, are taken by the Uruk-hai. Gandalf at this point is dead. Boromir at this point is dead.
Yeah.
For two totally different reasons. Right. So it's all broken up. In the book, I want to say that like that basically happens, but you don't quite get the sense of where everyone's landed until the very start of Two Towers. Right. I want to say that Aragorn comes across like the dying Boromir. I want to say at the very start of the Two Towers book.
Yeah, I think so. Because because Boromir, he does die at the end of Fellowship.
Yeah.
But it's not totally resolved. It's a little
in the book,
right? Yeah, because they're gonna revisit it.
Yeah,
right next.
Yeah, I need to reread that, but I'm pretty sure that that's where it is. But it's pretty dang close. The Two Towers is a little bit more significant of a thing. It's still close, but it's like they stop before Shelob, in the Two Towers, movies.
Yes,
in the books, you might be surprised to know that the Two Towers. Book ends with Shelob, and so I am pretty sure it ends with I think him realizing that Frodo isn't dead. I think, but anyways, that's another movie, another time. So anyhow, that's that. So that's basically what's going on, the basic plot. If you haven't seen it, but if you have seen
so there
it,
you go.
If you have seen it, that's good. Well, so one of the things we really wanted to get into was just like celebrating. Then, like we said, some of the themes, some of the the imagery that I think maps on and that has like spiritual significance. And also, I think I had like a few fun questions, and I know you threw on there too some fun questions of just like, what's your favorite? Blah, blah, blah. And I thought that'd be fun to just talk about. Because I want to hear your thoughts. So yeah. I don't think we mentioned this at the start of the podcast, but this one is another one of our filmed ones. We film like every fifth episode.
That's
and so you can check this out on YouTube if you are just listening to it as a podcast. And we'd love to hear, maybe like in the YouTube comments, you could comment some of your answers to some of these like questions, some of your thoughts about the Fellowship of the Ring. So do it.
Or if you're on Apple Podcast or Spotify or whatever you listen on, leave us a review.
Yeah.
If you want,
please do.
We love that.
Yeah. So what do you think? Do you want to get into like spiritual significance or more of these fun questions? Leaving it to Ali.
What if we do? Because I feel like it's just going to end up bleeding with some of these.
Yes, so I totally agree.
Do you want to just go for it?
Let's just go for totally fun bleed. Questions.
Yeah.
So I'll ask the first fun question. What is your favorite Hobbit?
So this is sad, but I don't remember the difference between Merry and Pippin right off the bat here.
That's awesome.
Which one is asking about breakfast?
Pippin.
Okay, Merry is my favorite Hobbit then.
Oh, really?
I love Merry. I think he has a lovely little arc.
Yeah.
Where he's not Samwise Gamgee, which is destined to be great.
Yeah.
You know,
totally
in some way. Or Frodo, who's the ring bearer.
Yeah.
He's your standard dude doing well.
Yeah.
I mean, he's got great moments over the series, but in the first installment in particular, the movie, he demonstrates that, you know, once he's in it, he's in it, you know, he's going for it. He's like, Mary, I don't think he knows about second breakfast and all the stuff. And he's there and he's present and he's sticking his neck out for folks and being brave and courageous and encouraging others. And he's not in the forefront. And so I appreciate him as kind of a side character, but still, you know, being a very upright dude.
Totally.
Yeah. I mean, he for his state, you know?
Yeah. That's amazing. I love
like
that.
one of the good good brother. He's a good brother.
Yeah. That's awesome. Okay. Well, for me, I think I have to cheat and say, I really can't totally choose between Sam or Frodo.
Jeez.
I think Sam. So, okay. Can I tell you, when I was a kid, my buddy and I started a Lord of the Rings, club, in our hometown.
What does that mean?
Well, I'll tell you what it means. Okay. We would meet at each other's houses. Every house had a different name of a tavern from the Lord of the Rings, so like the Prancing Pony, the Green Lantern, the Green Dragon.
Yeah.
And there's other taverns as well. And we would drink root beer or ginger ale.
Of course.
We'd eat mushrooms, fried mushrooms.
That's
Hobbits
tasty.
Eat mushrooms. Yeah. Mushrooms. And we would play Lord of the Rings games. We had a Lord of the Rings trading card game and Lord of the Rings Risk and all this.
Okay.
We watched the movies.
Wow.
We did all sorts of things. And we also, each of us had a name, like an identity.
What?
So, yeah. So I was Sam.
Was kicking. Wow.
And my best friend who we're still best friends at age now 30 something. He was Frodo. So it's Frodo and Sam. And it was just a beautiful, beautiful thing. So
that's amazing.
So I've always probably identified most with Sam or connected with him. And I love his story.
Mm-hmm.
But I also identify with Frodo and just how kind of just pasty faced and, you know, kind of just weighed down he gets by the ring over
his classic, like,
yes.
His face is.
Yeah. I love it. I relate to that. And I think I love him so much. Mm. And of course, like, I love my, my best friend. And so I really appreciate, like, that Frodo Sam dynamic, but that would be my answer. So,
nice. So
with that, like, so let's jump into like spiritual significance of that.
How
about that? So for the Hobbits, you were just mentioning like Merry, the thing you see about him is just being like a faithful friend, like a solid, just
a sturdy shelter,
sturdy shelter.
He that is found. One
yeah.
Is found no,
that's a really
treasure.
Good, that's a really yeah. good point. I really like him especially because Pippin is more of like, you know, fool the took, and he's
hurry yourself in next time and save us your stupidity.
That was a really good impression. So he's like the more of the comic relief, whereas Merodach is more a little bit more like I love in Return of the King when he says to Pippin, like, I don't know, Pip, like when he's just being very honest about, like, I don't know if I'll see you again, like,
yeah,
and like, it's just, yeah, he's so good. And of course,
he's also fun to watch. Dominic
Monaghan is the actor.
Of all of the hot, wait, just right off the bat there. Yeah. That was great, man.
Totally.
There's actors out there that are, even if they're in a garbage movie, I would go watch because I'm like, I just genuinely enjoy, you're just an entertaining person kind of thing. I think we talked about last episode, Colin Farrell, is that who we were? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
He's just interesting to watch.
Yeah.
I think I would probably go see him in most things he's just really engaging and dynamic, I think.
Totally.
And, you know, and there's always exceptions, right? Like Natalie Portman, some of her lines in the prequel trilogy are not exactly stellar, but I think she's a great actress.
Yeah.
I think she does a lot of good work.
Yeah.
But at any rate, I think that Mary and Pippin in some ways are kind of a smaller little Frodo and Sam, but they have the... It's a gift and a curse in some ways of being more familial. Yeah. So they already have a pre-established bond of brotherhood, whereas Frodo and Sam are kind of forging theirs.
Yeah.
But I also think that's a hindrance to them at times because they are assuming some brotherhood things where they actually still need to work through and kind of problem solve and argue to get to a place of understanding and this sort of thing. So it's interesting how those two relationships kind of mirror each other as far as brotherhood goes.
That's cool. Yeah, you're right. Because they're already, because they come into it as, you can tell that they're close friends. Mary and Pippin. Whereas Frodo and Sam, like, they have a different relationship. There's like a master-servant type of relationship in some ways. There's a class difference there. But they become like authentic friends over the course of it.
Because Sam's...
His gardener.
Was it Sam's... And his father was Bilbo's gardener.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. So he's basically the apprentice. And,
yeah,
exactly. Right. Yeah. Oh, that's cool. And then, so I think for me, of course, Sam just, gosh, so such a faithful person, such a... like the scene at the end might be my favorite scene. It's definitely the one I cry the most at is when Frodo is in the boat and he's like, I'm going without you, or whatever, Sam. And what does Sam say? He says, like...
Of course you are, and I'm going with you.
Like that. Exactly. Yeah. And he comes out...
Mr. Frodo.
Yeah. You can't swim, Sam. And so he starts to drown. Yeah, like, what a powerful scene.
Totally epic. I love those shots with the hand.
Yes. And the swell of the music.
Yeah. Oh,
so good.
Just wonderful.
When he pulls them in, they're just like crying and stuff. That's so good. It's so good. So that's what I love about Sam and Frodo and like a beautiful, beautiful end of the film. Mm-hmm. And so that's them. Yeah. Okay, what about the next one? Favorite member of the Fellowship in general? So is it still Mary? Or is it, you know, do you like Aragorn, favorite Legolas, Gandalf, Gimli?
I mean, Gandalf. I hope that's not...
You said Gandalf? Sorry.
Gandalf, yeah. Nice, Gandalf, right. I think, because he's just such a good father, and he possesses a quality that I think many men miss out on in their fatherhood, and that is...
Let's get into this.
Owning their weakness.
Ooh.
Because Gandalf is confronted with this evil, the Balrog.
Yeah.
And he faces it.
Yeah.
He faces this... enemy, right? Yeah. And he is willing to do whatever it takes to end it for the betterment of everyone.
Yeah.
Which means, of course, falling and presumably dying and coming back and all this stuff. Oh, spoilers. I think many men in their lifetimes are presented with opportunities to be humbled, especially in their, you know, in their vocation as a father, however the Lord calls them to that, which I think we can say Gandalf is in his vocation as a father
and
being mentor and, you know, protector and provider in this way. And they're presented with an opportunity to be humble and really, really humble, right? Like when the Lord presents opportunities, big opportunities of conversion for us, especially the deeper in a relationship we go with him, it gets harder, I think, anyway, you know, because we can kind of handle more, seems to be the general or I don't know, the consistent thing I've observed anecdotally anyway, yeah. that, you know, as we grow in the faith, he gives us more kind of thing. And we're getting more grace too, is the yeah, beautiful thing, right? Yeah, so yeah. Gandalf is now confronted with this seemingly unconquerable evil, right? It's this massive,
yeah.
flaming, scary looking thing that can summon weapons out of fire and whatever.
Yeah.
And he knows he's the one, and he knew he was the one, and he tried to avoid it. He didn't want to go into the mountain, but he does anyway for the betterment of the company. And then when he's faced with it, he's like, I have to deal with this, and I'm the only one that can.
Totally.
And it's not a prideful thing when he says that, right? It's an objective truth. Gandalf is the only one that could contend with this evil.
Right.
And I think to apply personally, like many times in our lives, we are the only ones that can confront and deal with the sin in our lives, like our sin. Mm. It is up to us to get our tuchus to the confessional.
Yeah.
And in our contrition and in our penance to resolve to be better and then to be better, right? It's not up to the priest. It's not up to your father. It's not up to your brother. It's not up to your best friend. It's up to you to be transformed not to be transformed. Lord gives mercy and you're transformed.
Yeah.
But to act on the grace you've been given.
Right.
It's up to you. You're the only one that can act on the grace you're being given. You know?
Yeah.
So if you have difficult circumstances, you have difficult circumstances.
Yeah.
And we all do, right? Like,
totally.
No one is making it out of here alive, you know? And that means we're going to endure a certain amount of suffering. It's what we do with the circumstances we've been handed. Mm. And you know, and that's Gandalf is, you know, Frodo says, I wish it had never come to me.
Yeah.
And what does Gandalf say? It's this beautiful.
So do all who live to see such times.
Exactly.
That is not for them to decide.
Mm-hmm.
All you have to decide is what to do with the time that is given to you.
Yeah, which is beautiful because Frodo does that. But in that moment, I would say Gandalf is totally reflecting on the passion he's about to go through.
Yeah, that's a good,
you know,
great
it's
point,
it's a total him.
I think you're totally right. And I think maybe two things there is like, I think there's a total truth to affirm of like, only you can take that on.
Yeah.
But on the other hand too, there's a way in which also there's an image of like Gandalf almost like Christ, like going to battle on our behalf in a sense too.
Yeah. Oh, amen. Totally.
Yeah. He definitely is one of the Christ figures. There's multiple, I think, in the
story.
Which
is so great.
Yeah.
I do love that about this series in particular, as opposed to the Chronicles of Narnia, where it's like Aslan is the clear Christ kind of figure.
In this, it's like there's multiple, and it shows how we each actually are called to imitate Christ in these
priest, prophet, king.
Priest, prophet, and king. Exactly. You could say right there, like Gandalf's more of like the prophet, Aragorn maybe more the king, or obviously.
But they do interplay.
Yes, for sure. And Frodo, like his sacrifice and his like his carrying the ring. Yeah, I totally love that. I love that. So Gandalf for you. That's so interesting. I'm thinking too, actually, something about that that's really beautiful is how Gandalf, I love that scene when he's meeting with Saruman. And he's just very like gracious with Saruman and very like humble and kind of like almost like bent over. Like
he is bent over. Absolutely.
Yeah, in that scene. And Saruman is just very dismissive of him. And he says, your love of the halfling's leaf has clearly slowed your mind, which is kind of a funny thing because he's been smoking that, you know, those pipes. But like the point there is actually more that he's associating with the humble, simple halflings.
He's smelling like the sheep.
To use that phrase.
Saruman is
again,
all.
Yeah, totally.
My staff
Saruman
is
yeah, is in his tower and just alone there and then making these disgusting creatures. Ugh. So I think Gandalf is a great example to me of, have you ever as a, net missionary, maybe someone questioned a little bit of like, wow, so you're going out on you're going out and being with like these high schoolers and middle schoolers doing those like silly skits and stuff. Like,
yeah.
Have you ever had that? Like someone kind of question you on that?
Yeah. I don't think so. I haven't encountered folks that see interacting with high schoolers and middle schoolers as the lower thing. What I did encounter is net missionaries are required to fundraise.
Yeah.
And I was fundraising for 3 years. So I fundraised for 1 year to be a team member, missionary on a retreat team. Then I fundraised for 2 years to be a supervisor overseeing a couple teams over that time. And that was something people were like, When are you going to like actually make money?
Yeah.
You know, why are you
totally,
why are you doing this kind of thing? And you know, they're very pleasant about it. I didn't have anyone, you know, be super venomous about it, but it was a lot of kind of passivity, like, oh, you're doing that again.
For sure. For sure.
They're just like, yeah. Yeah. Like, no, what about it?
I think that definitely happens. No. But even also too, like, I think about like when we're, you know, when we have our missionary teams, mm-hmm. there could be times where people can kind of joke about like, oh yeah, I had a team of missionaries and like, you know, and like kind of like be silly about how, you know, they're very, you know, young, they're missionaries and like, and kind of, I don't know, some people can be a little bit judgy, I think, of like,
sure.
Of how, you know, young they might be or like, you know, because they're young people acting as young people do. So I don't know. I just really love, to me, Gandalf just being an example of like, what a beautiful calling though, to like, to work with young people, either the high schoolers, middle schoolers, or even just the young missionaries, you know, like what a beautiful gift and nothing, something that you shouldn't be looking down your nose at, you know, like,
oh yeah.
Cause it's needed.
Yeah. Well, and the beauty of, I mean, you're talking about missionaries. In so many words, it sounds like anyway, missionaries acting like the high schoolers they're ministering to at times.
Yeah.
Is, you know, right. It's, you know, we want to be professional, right? Yeah. You know, we're trying to be professional and all this stuff, but it also, there's a beautiful thing to, I think, being just slightly more mature than the high schoolers, but you still, I mean, I know I received so much life from being around young people and their energy and that sort of thing. And the energy multiplies usually. Right, so if you've got an energetic person on retreat, I'm like through the roof because I just had five retreats where people wouldn't even look at me kind of thing. And now there's some kid that's like, hey, it's good to see you. And I'm like, yeah, it's good to see you too.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah.
So I think, so it is a bummer when there's some, you know, but it, you know, and it's always, I could be a
I like that. Maybe good we'll image. There, maybe we'll good image there, on that would be when they're smoking the pipes and Bilbo makes a smoke ring,
and then Gandalf sends a boat,
a smoke boat through
literal
it.
Boat.
So a little example of being like just a step ahead.
Just a step ahead. Maybe like
those you're ministering to.
A hundred steps ahead.
I love that. I love that.
A few hundred.
Well, okay, a few other pieces.
Which one?
What about favorite piece from the soundtrack? What do you think? Does anything come to mind of
the
like,
Shire, man?
The Shire?
The Shire.
Just the that flute. The.
Yeah. It's just so lovely.
It's so lovely.
And it's used. So, something that. So, there's a few music tropes, that I can say. Motifs that are. Well, or trends is probably the better word for what I'm going for right now. Okay. That are being used a lot. So, the one I particularly enjoy is having a happy song in an action sequence.
Oh yeah.
Where it's like,
totally.
I would never listen to this song while I was, you know, fighting for my life kind of thing.
Yeah.
And some people have done it really well. And then lesser attempts are made because they're just trying to make the money. Is what it ends up feeling like. Okay. It feels as an audience member. I'm like, okay, you're just trying to make the money that other movie made, which was really good, but you're doing half the work.
Yeah.
And your action sequence is lame and you're using actors that don't actually know how to do a fight choreo. And it's subpar because clearly they don't know how to fight and you tried to throw in some cool music and it's dumb and you're dumb. And I hate that I spent money on this.
It hasn't really to this then.
Yeah. So another trend that is used is having a happy theme that is then used later on in a more serious context.
Yes.
And that can also be done super poorly because if you don't earn the first time, when you do it the second time, people don't care.
So
they think that you're just trying to use their emotions to get them to enjoy the film. But if you justify it and you earn it the first time, then when it comes around the second time, the audience doesn't feel like you're playing with their emotions. They feel like they're with the character.
It's authentic.
Right, it's an authentic representation. So the Shire theme is lovely. On its own. If you just listen to the Shire theme, you will feel like you are a part of the community.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're like, I am.
Yes.
I am a part of the Shire.
Totally.
And so because it evokes that sentiment on the part of the viewer, when it's brought around it's brought around a few times. Probably the most potent is at the base of Mount Dune or Doom or wherever it is on the mountain that it happens.
Yeah.
And I think I teared up as a boy watching it because I was so drawn into their plight in the moment.
Yeah.
And I thought of my own home. I was sitting in my home watching, and I thought of my own home, and I thought of myself on Mount Doom, and I was just so taken by that trial, but the beauty of the trial too. And so I love it because I think it's a very simple theme, which I think all good themes are.
Yeah.
It's predominantly stepwise, if I remember correctly anyway, so it's nothing too crazy, but it is just lovely, and it really captures, I think it captures what they were going for, and then it's used well. It's not used to manipulate. It's used to enter in and provide an opportunity as opposed to forcing an experience.
I totally agree with all that. You know,
that's the Shire.
That's my favorite too. And but specifically for the first reason one. You just said, which of being not only like the original song, but the way that it then gets incorporated into the breaking of the fellowship, track 17 on the soundtrack, the way it like is used again.
Andy just referenced the exact soundtrack number.
Oh, the soundtrack
seamlessly without break.
Yeah. But it was that one. They actually add lyrics to it in the very end. I don't know if you hear.
I didn't realize that.
You don't hear it until like the credits, I think.
Okay.
But it's like, you know, when the cold of winter comes, that whole
is it from the book? Do they use some text there, or?
Oh gosh,
that's worth noting. The book sings way more than the movie does.
So many songs,
which is really cool because J.R.R. Tolkien was trying to build like a kind of
world
English. Yeah. I mean, mythology is what he was going for because. I think he largely attributed it to the invading Normans, right? That they lost so much.
In 1066, when the Normans invaded England, they had horses.
Yeah.
And the English people did not. And he believed that at the Battle of Hastings, if they'd had horses, it would have been, England would have maintained its own culture and mythology instead
of
being Frenchified.
What was the native people?
I think the Saxons.
Saxons. Yeah. Saxons.
Yeah. And so that's why the Rohirrim in the Two Towers represent that. They basically are almost a total match for Old English culture.
Yeah.
Plus horses.
Right.
Like horses instead of ships, basically. Mm-hmm. And wow, the Two Towers soundtrack has some bangers as well. Oh my gosh, especially for the Rohirrim. But I totally agree with that. Shire theme and then how it's re-implemented and reused is incredible, and the use of the music is just amazing. Actually, shout out to another podcast you could listen to, which is The Soundtrack Show.
Ooh.
And he does incredible explainers on soundtracks of all kinds. So many John Williams soundtracks. That's all fair. The Star Wars movies, etc. Jurassic Park, Harry Potter, all that. But for The Lord of the Rings, which was the soundtrack was by Howard Shore, he has like two or three parts on that. And
you totally
an interview
told,
with a guy who wrote a book about the music of it. And like, it's incredible. It's
someone
incredible.
Wrote a book about the music of the movie?
Oh, yeah. And it's amazing. It's amazing. And just Howard Shore literally sitting there with the books as he's writing the music, and just such a huge fan of the books. And
that helps, man. Yeah. You have to. Yeah, that helps so much.
Yeah, it's so incredible what he did, and like it's really cool to see how he tapped into even like the Western tradition of music and the Catholic tradition of music as well, with Gregorian chant and all that. So maybe a big wrapping up piece would be what are some of the other like spiritual significance that you see in the Fellowship of the Ring, not to just like be too forward about it, but I just think there's so many incredible images that in the Lord of the Rings, but in the Fellowship of the Ring too. To my mind, for example, I'm just thinking of someone like Galadriel being such an interesting
image. You like the significance
hair?
Behind her handing Gimli the hair.
Okay, talk about that. What's the significance of Galadriel gives Gimli strands of her
hair. Asks for a single strand, but she gives him three.
Yeah,
I think.
Yes.
And the significance is also that scene, like there's a boat and they fall there, like they come out on their big old boat to wish them off on their little boats in the book. Yeah. It doesn't happen in the movie.
Yeah.
It was just fine because I didn't feel like I lost anything there.
Totally.
That and they're you totally feel the pressure of them being pursued into the forest in the book. Wow. Oh my gosh. Okay.
I need to read
some differences, man. That's some differences.
Yeah.
It's significant because, and I haven't read the Silmarillion, so this is all second class or third class, I guess, knowledge.
Yeah.
But at one point, there's an evil elf that is, I think, like lusting after Galadriel or desiring to be with her or whatever, but he's a bad dude. And she's like, no way, Jose. And he asks for
a strand of her hair.
Really?
She's like, nah, you ain't pure. Like, wow. Get out of my face. And in those words, exactly.
Yeah.
And so the beauty of her handing to Gimli is that Gimli genuinely seeks nothing else.
Yeah.
He is just so taken by her beauty, and he's not, you know, he's not trying to, you know, he's not lusting after her. He's just genuinely enraptured by her beauty.
Yeah.
And asks for a single strand of her hair, and she gives him three as a sign of like, no, you are good.
Wow. That's so cool.
And I think that's so lovely for, you know, I don't know. I think you could compare it to a few things, but I mean, immediately comes to mind, you know, the fall of Adam and Eve and the redemption in our Mother Mary and Christ and some of that sort of stuff. I would have to work hard to make a connection there, but I think there's something there potentially. Well, it's just a beautiful spiritual.
It is. And you mentioned second class, third class information, but it makes me think of like it's sort of a second class or third class or whatever relic. It's like a relic of her on some level.
Which would be first, right?
Yeah, I guess first class. And it's like, and it almost reminds me of Mary's mantle, you know, in some ways, like, and just giving like a piece of, I think that just, I think she is clearly derived from Tolkien's love and devotion for the Blessed Mother.
Yeah.
And so if we were mapping that over, I think that the thing you could take away from that is that like Mary wants to have that intimate relationship with us and have that, like, she wants to give to us a piece of herself to hold on to. And if we ask for something, like, she's going to give it threefold.
Yeah.
You know? I think that that's true. And go ahead.
Which is so, so, I mean, you, cause we can assume that, you know, she was tempted mightily by the evil one, right? I mean, she was
Mary.
Yeah. Mary. Absolutely. I mean, you know, she experienced temptation, of course. Yeah. She never sinned, but so, I mean, just looking at, you know, how
she passes the test like that.
Passes the test. And then previously you've got this evil elf after her, and she's like, nay. Yeah,
totally.
I think there's definitely some very interesting things to draw.
Marian
there.
Images there. Yeah. Well, and even with the other gifts. So in the extended edition, you see her give out other gifts. You see her give the file of Galadriel, which is like the little,
may our brightest star.
Yeah. Our brightest star. There you go.
Shine.
May it be a light to you.
Maybe a light to you when all other lights
go out. And then also
her voice is amazing.
Lembas bread.
Yeah.
And kind of like Lembas and was it Miravir, I think is what they call it, is the wine.
And what's the rope?
There's
some rope handed out to Sam.
There's also a rope.
Yeah.
I forgot about the rope. And maybe
it's really good rope.
Yeah.
Really good rope.
But in the movies I don't think you see the Miravir, but in the books it's literally bread and wine. It's Lembas and Miravir. And they're both have these life-giving properties that are way beyond anything normal.
No, I remember this.
But in the movies, you definitely see the Lembas spread,
right.
At least by the two towers you see it. But the phrase they say is a single bite, a single morsel.
Sustain a man for a while.
I don't know how long. But that's... If that's not a symbol of the Eucharist, like some morsel of it sustaining us, what is? Like, that's amazing.
Yeah, that's good.
And then also the file of Galadriel, like, to me, has always been such a beautiful thing. So in the Return of the King, you see him actually use it, and he pulls it out, and he says the prayer in Elvish, which Elvish in that way is almost like Latin. Like, it's like a traditional language that's like, it has like a connection to...
It's beautiful.
...to grace and beauty.
Yeah.
And he cries out in that almost as you would like cry out Salve Regina, you know, or Ave Maria. And there's a light like comes into that moment. And in the movie, The Return of the King, it actually like... he like is knocked down at one point, and he's actually like... He then sees Galadriel as if he's somewhere else. And then she like pulls him up, and he's like pulled up into like standing up right again. And to me, that is such an incredible image of grace. Right. And like through this sacramental, right. Mm-hmm. The file of Galadriel, he's able to be connected with the grace of Galadriel and the grace of the star, which it's not just a star. I'm pretty sure it's an actual, like, it's it like is the person or the light of a person, like an actual angelic person. Mm-hmm. I think. Gilbereth, maybe. I'm mixing it up, but yeah, just all these beautiful sacramental images mm-hmm. that Mary gives. And the thing is, like, not only does like are they given this bread and wine, but like but Galadriel gives it to them, which again, like, from a spiritual significance, like, she I think we need to go to Mary more to receive the sacraments from her. Mm. You know what I'm saying?
Who is standing at the foot of the cross? Yeah.
Yeah, Mary, who birthed Jesus for us, who Jesus,
the first tabernacle,
to come to us through his mother.
He does.
Like,
yeah.
And so I think that, like, I don't know, I just really love that. And I know that, like, that's how Tolkien saw it. So, I mean, this is not a stretch. Like, this is definitely like what he was, what inspired him was his relationship with Mary and how he saw her in the life of grace.
Yeah.
So, yeah, gosh. Well, anything you want to say to wrap this up? We didn't talk about the Fellowship of the Ring. This is like my dream come true. I love these books so much and the movies so much. Yeah. Any kind of closing message at all?
Watch it.
Watch it. Watch
it. The beauty is I think there's so many things. You know, there's very typical. I think there's some standard themes that are elaborated upon. You get the classic Catholic men's talk. That Samwise Gamgee, we should all be like that. We use that. And it's really a great in our formation for missionary men.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, and it's beautiful. I think the beauty of the books, though, is that that's not the only one. There's a lot to draw on.
Totally.
So please. Worth a read.
Yes, exactly. Do both. Let us know what you prefer, the books, the movie, the soundtrack. And we hope you enjoyed listening to today's episode. Join us next week when we cover the critically acclaimed video game, God of War.
All the cinematic cutscenes.
Yeah.
Though They Die is sponsored by Net Ministries. To get in touch with Andy and Ali, email us at thoughtheydie@netusa.org.
And to get involved as a net missionary, go to netusa.org/apply and apply today. Thank you.
Do it.